House Judiciary Committee this afternoon. We apologize for our late start. We were all being briefed further about the budget. Just so everyone knows, they have stationed fire personnel around the building to put people's hair out after they've lit themselves on fire this afternoon. So let us know if anybody needs that assistance. We're going to start today in the public hearings on House Bill 3520. And I'm going to open a public hearing on that bill and ask Representative Anderson to take a position at the table and to bring up your witness. And begin when you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, Gordon Anderson, representative from District 3, Josephine County, Grants Pass, Cave Junction. I have today with me a friend and a constituent from Grants Pass area presenting, I think, a very reasonable request that could be implemented to make seatbelt learning and seatbelt school more open to more people. And I'm going to let Joyce Delphi, a close friend, present her situation. Just briefly, there were two issues. We talked about carrying a bill for the actual placement of a seatbelt, whether it went over the shoulder or under the arm, and we dropped that bill simply because I think there is adequate legislation in that area at this time. But there's another issue, and that is who should be or who should not be able to go to seatbelt school, and I will have Mrs. Delphi present her situation to you.
Welcome.
Welcome. Chairman Williams and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Joyce Delphi. I'm from Grants Pass, Oregon, and I'm here to testify in favor of House Bill 3520. On the morning of May 20th, I was returning from Medford, and I was a passenger in the pickup driven by my husband, and unfortunately I had the seatbelt under my arm, and we got pulled over, and I tried to explain to the officer that it cuts me when it goes over my throat, but anyway, he gave me a ticket. And so when I went to the court, because I felt like I was in compliance with the law because I did have the seatbelt hooked up, I was found guilty and I had a fine of $50, which wasn't the point. The point is my friend had got a ticket just a few weeks before, and she had the opportunity to go to seatbelt school and learn the proper way of doing it, and also didn't go on her driving record. And I understand that mine has gone on my driver's record, and I feel like that because I pleaded innocent when I thought I was innocent, that I forfeited my right, as the judge told me, that I had forfeited my right to attend the school to learn more about seat belts, and it would go on my driver's record. And I thank you for the opportunity to hear me on this issue. I'll be happy to answer any questions if anyone has any.
Thank you, Ms. Delphi. Are there questions for either she or Representative Anderson?
Mr. Chair, could I just add one comment or two? I think the whole purpose of having a seatbelt school is to inform people, educate people as to how to safely protect themselves in case of an accident by proper use of the seatbelt. And it just seemed to us, as we talked this over with the Delphis, that the real point is let's get people into seatbelt school. They pay an extra fee to go to school. And while it is a small irritation to the courts, they've already been paid their fee through the fine that the cited person has already paid. And it just seemed to me a simple correction to the system to be able to say, whether you're guilty or not, we want you to know how to do it in the future. We're going to let you go to school to learn how to use your seatbelt accurately. So that's the issue, and we appreciate your hearing the testimony here.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. Are there any questions? Representative Barker.
Representative Anderson, on this, in the past on similar issues, judges have been very reluctant to have us impose a requirement on them. Would this be acceptable to you if that was modified so that it would allow the court to offer it rather than requiring the court to offer it? There are some cases, if somebody is very belligerent with a judge, they might not want to do that. And if we say require, we might run into a problem.
That's fine.
I think that would be a reasonable intermediary.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you very much. Next up, Brad Swank and Carl Myers, if they'd both come up together.
You want me to go first?
Mr. Myers.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Carl Myers, for your record, on behalf of the Oregon Municipal Judges Association, the Oregon Justice of the Peace Association, both associations have instructed me to appear and to oppose this bill. I want to make sure that the committee understands that we do not condone any judges that arbitrarily exercise their discretion in these kinds of diversion cases, but I need to make sure that you understand that diversion on a traffic offense is not a right. It is a discretionary thing with the court. We are concerned that by requiring diversion classes in all cases, that you've taken away the judge's discretion to offer them or to refuse discretion in cases where it would be inappropriate. I had a case in Kaiser Municipal Court not but a month ago, same fact situation as the Delphi's had. But the defendant, even after a trial, was unrepentant, to say the least, thought the law was wrong and that our enforcement of it was wrong. When I imposed a fine, which was about the same fine as Mrs. Delphi got, she asked for the diversion program, but I had to tell her that at that point in the situation, it wasn't going to be helpful to her or to the court. If she didn't understand that what she had done was in violation of the rule. But this bill, as it presently constituted, would apply to all traffic violations, not just seatbelts. And seatbelts, I think, are the case where there are most diversion programs. But we would, again, like to make sure that remains in the discretion of the judge. There are a number of reasons why a judge may not allow a diversion program. We think most judges think it's inappropriate just because somebody exercises their constitutional right to a hearing to deny them diversion, but there may be things that come out in the hearing that would suggest that the defendant would not benefit from the diversion, the community would not benefit from the diversion, and that a simple imposition of a small fine, seatbelt violations, by the way, are Class D traffic violations.
Okay, Mr. Swank, and then we'll do questions.
For the record, Chair Williams, members of the committee, my name is Brad Swank. I am Special Counsel for Government Relations for the Oregon Judicial Department. I'm going to take a slightly different tack. I'm talking about some of the technical issues that are presented by the bill as written. The testimony that you got from Representative Anderson and his constituent was directed to seat belts. As Mr. Myers mentioned, this bill is not limited to seat belts. It, in fact, applies to any traffic violation. There are some things when we were asked to do a fiscal one, and we haven't done a fiscal yet because we thought we'd come and hear what's going on at the hearing before we started spending time and money chasing down specific costs. The first thing we noticed about the bill as written is that there is no time limit on when you can apply. It says that a court, if they offer an educational or remedial program, apparently any educational or remedial program, must allow any person who's issued a citation for a traffic violation the opportunity to complete the program and have the ticket dismissed, whether or not the person has entered a plea or been convicted of a traffic violation. It doesn't say within 5 years, within 30 days, within 10 years. So there's no limit on the number or on the time within which you have to apply or the time after the conviction potentially, that you could come in. One of the questions that was asked me by one of the analysts in our office was, well, does this mean if you had an habitual offense proceeding going against you, you could go in and make application to go to traffic school at some court that had traffic school and pop some of those convictions off so you were no longer an habitual offender? And I said, well, I don't know. I'll have to look on that. Which raised the next issue, is there's no limit on the number of offenses that you can clear off by going to traffic school, with the bill as written. Is it one? Is it two? Is it just a seat belt offense? Is it any traffic violation, speeding, whatever, or any particular number? By going to traffic school once, can you pick off two or three of them for an opportunity? The next technical question that's raised is, what happens to the money, particularly on a conviction, if you were convicted and were going to set aside the ticket, which is the charging instrument, and the record from DMV? What happens if you have paid a fine to the state for the conviction and then you change your mind? Does the money go back to the person who had paid the fine? It is all of these things, particularly since you're removing judicial discretion, would be issues that would be subject to litigation because the bill itself is not clear, and I think as written could create some havoc in the traffic violation world, with people going back and trying to get potentially relatively old and maybe a large number of traffic violations removed by finding a court that has a traffic school and going to that and saying you don't have any discretion but to remove these because I've completed traffic school. Those are the technical issues that we noted that caused us some pause in looking at the bill. And for us, as written, we feel that it could have a substantial impact on probably we handle more traffic cases in our courts than we handle anything else, just in sheer number of cases. And I know that the municipal and justice courts actually handle more traffic cases than we do statewide. So as written, this could cause a lot of chaos for a number of courts. And I'll answer any questions.
Thank you. Mr. Myers, explain to me how it works now. If someone pleads, under the current rule, if someone does enter a plea of not guilty, are they at that point barred from diversion, or do you still have the discretion as a municipal judge to order
Mr.
diversion?
Chair, I can only speak for my court. There is no statutory rule. I offer diversion as a judge even after a finding of guilty at a hearing under the appropriate circumstances. It is, again, exercising your right to a hearing is not an absolute bar. But there is no statutory reference to specify diversion programs, and judges handle it in a number of different ways. There are, I might say, Mr. Chair, there are a number of judges who do not allow diversion at all because they believe that since there is no statutory reference to traffic diversions that they don't have the discretion to do that. But I think a majority of the judges I've come in contact with have some kind of diversion plan for first-time offenders, possibly juveniles. In my court, I handle it this way. If a person pleads guilty or is found guilty, then I continue sentencing for a period of time to allow them to go through diversion program. If they successfully complete the program, then the matter is simply dismissed, so it doesn't even go into DMV as a conviction that I would have to reverse at some point. I think there are a number of judges who do require a guilty plea, similar to what happens in DUII diversions. Require a guilty plea before a diversion is offered, but a number of judges I've talked to will offer them even after a hearing, again under the appropriate circumstances.
Yes, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It would seem to me there was some fairly simple changes regarding seat belt rather than traffic, maybe adding who in the court's opinion would benefit, and dealing with the actual dismissal of the citation, we could come to a fairly reasonable amendment on this. Would you be open to that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I would. Again, there are a number of judges who don't offer diversion at all or have a very strict policy for that, only offer it in some instances, only offer it, and again, they have their own reasons for that. I would say, Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I know that if there is a policy that I have that people that appear in front of me do not like, they have the opportunity to go to my city council and put pressure on me to change my policy. That has not occurred. But if there is a judge that is abusing discretion in some way, particularly at the municipal court level, we'd like to see it handled that way rather than through legislation. But I think if it were clear that diversion is possible on some cases at the court's discretion, we would not oppose that at all.
Were you done, Representative Anderson? Let me ask, Carl, I heard one of the comments you made was that the mandatory, the use of the word must, that the court must, your indication is that there are some courts who don't offer it at all because they don't think they're entitled to. There might be some courts who follow, as you point out, the rule in DUII that they feel like if unless it's a guilty plea, they won't offer it. If we simply change the word from must to may so we weren't forcing the court but still allowing the discretion, do you think that might offer some judges who currently may be either feel A, they can't get there, or B, they're hamstrung by the way it's approached in DUII, some flexibility then to exercise their discretion and in their judgment exercise a determination to give diversion as you do in some cases?
Mr. Chair, I think that is a possibility. And if you wanted to even make it stronger and say that judges in traffic courts can offer diversion, then I think that would be a clearer signal than saying if they do, then they may. But and that's your public policy, Mr. Chair. But we only oppose the requirement that it be offered in all cases.
Chair. And if we did that and then addressed the issues that Mr. Swank raised about a time limit, indicating that it's essentially at the time of the arraignment or the appearance, and they've got to decide then, and they can't come back 6 months after the fact and change their mind, but you tie it to the event, you limit it to one time or some limitation to the number of times that it's allowed. If it's been offered before for seatbelt offense, it doesn't seem like if you get caught a second time, you ought to be offered it again. So you limit it to the one time. Right. And obviously, if you don't have any look back, you don't have to worry about fines that have been previously paid. If those changes were made, would that eliminate the opposition, you think, Mr. Myers, from the
Chair, that would eliminate our opposition.
And Mr. Swank, that would eliminate your concern.
Chair Williams, it would. I would add to that you probably want, if they're going to offer diversion, to really make it a diversion program so that it happens, as Mr. Myers said, before the conviction sent to DMV, that the diversion happens then, because that way, first of all, you don't end up changing records. And second of all, once the record is sent to DMV, even if you later change it, the damage is sort of done, because we have private enterprise that gets copies of their records and our records of the convictions monthly. So even if we don't have the record, somebody's got the record of that conviction forever, and your insurance company is going to get it. So I would make that suggestion.
Okay. Then what I'm going to ask you two to do is to work with Representative Anderson and Counsel Joseph, draft up some amendments that would alleviate your concerns in the manner that we've sort of just discussed here in front of the committee, and get those amendments, and we'll get the bill back on the schedule.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're very welcome. Is there anything else on this bill? Okay, hearing none, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3520, and we'll make an announcement, program note changes, if you're following your program. We're pulling 2924 from the agenda, so we won't be addressing that bill today, and my understanding is the amendments for House Bill 3330 are not ready yet, so we will not be taking action on House Bill 3330 today. It'll appear on a later work session agenda. With that, we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2864. And I have Richard Thompson and David Schwent.
Yeah.
Welcome. Who's going to lead off?
I will, Mr. Chairman. I'm Richard Thompson. I'm a homeowner association management consultant based in Portland, Oregon, and also a member of the Oregon-Washington Community Association Managers, a professional trade group of management of homeowner association managers. We're here to promote the passage of House Bill 2864. A little bit of background. 2864 came about. Our neighbors, California and Washington, already have a similar statute which requires certain homeowner associations to have a financial review done on an annual basis. This is has been done because homeowner associations, there's approximately 1,500 of them in Oregon, control substantial amounts of funds. And by my statistics, almost 80% of them are self-managed, which means they're doing what they will with those funds, presumably handling them correctly. But there is a growing awareness of an issue that many associations are not having their books looked at by a professional or being done by a professional. There's concerns regularly expressed by members of those homeowner associations that the board may not be handling funds correctly. So House Bill 2864 is designed to address those concerns by making it a requirement that all homeowner associations that have annual assessments of $75,000 or more have a look at their books in terms of a financial review by a certified public accountant. Essentially, this is going to impact condominiums and other common wall homeowner associations of about 30 to 40 units or more, or planned communities, which are single-family homeowner associations that have substantial common area amenities, clubhouses and pools and whatnot, and are collecting money to pay for the maintenance of those things. Our bill includes a provision for any homeowner association that's affected by it to opt out of it with a 60% vote of the membership in any given year. So even though the provisions do apply to all that have $75,000 or more per year collected, there is an opt-out provision that for those that feel they don't want to go to the expense for whatever reason. We also in our bill have an opt-in provision for homeowner associations that fall below the cap of $75,000 if those homeowners feel that it's a good idea to have an outside accountant look at their books on an annual basis. And I think those are the major... yes, we did bring an amendment today that does... the original bill as presented did only impact homeowner associations that collected $75,000 or more after the effective date of the bill. Our amendment does include a retroactive provision to all homeowner associations that meet that cap, even pre-existing. So we felt that that was an important provision.
And that's the dash one amendment?
Yes.
That we have? So on the retroactivity issue, if I could, that essentially means that as the bill was originally drafted, it would only be a new homeowners association that over time accumulated or had fees paid into it in excess of $75,000. And what your
annually.
And what your bill is suggesting is that any current existing homeowners association that has at least $75,000 in annual fees would be subject to the bill as well.
That is correct. Okay. With the same opt-out provision if they choose.
Right. So if 60% of the membership decided to vote to not have to go through that process, then they wouldn't have to go through it.
Correct.
Okay. Mr. Schmidt, or Schwint, I'm sorry, Schwint, do you want to add anything?
Well, I'm a CPA in the state of Oregon, and I've been specializing in providing tax, accounting, and reserve study services to homeowner associations since 1984. And right now, we provide services to over 300 homeowner associations in the Pacific Northwest. So from my perspective, I see a wide variety of financial type record keeping out in the homeowner association community with sometimes not a lot of oversight other than somebody on the board of directors performing that function. And from a member standpoint, I think it would be valuable for the association to have an independent look at the financial statements on an annual basis. And as Mr. Thompson pointed out, California has a requirement for a reviewed financial statement. If there's any questions from the committee on the differences between a reviewed financial statement and an audited financial statement, I can answer those today. The state of Washington has a requirement to have homeowner associations, I believe it's the same level of assessments, to have an audited financial statement performed on an annual basis. So on either side of us, we have states that have recognized the importance of this, and what this bill is intending to do is to bring us in line with that recognition by the states on either side of us.
Mr. Chairman, if
I could just ask Mr. Schwint, now I want to follow you again. You say California requires that it be a reviewed statement.
Right.
Washington requires an audited statement.
Right.
And this bill is suggesting
a reviewed financial statement,
which is less intensive than an audited financial statement.
It's a lesser level of assurance that you receive from a CPA, and the fees are less as well. So we're trying to bring it in line, keep it affordable for homeowner associations.
Okay. Yes, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Does a reviewed statement essentially give just the principles by which the audit is done, as many audits do, or does it actually uncover untoward activities? Does
well,
it into the financial
even audit? Audits aren't we disclaim the discovery of fraud, although we have, and that's under review right now by a number of different bodies on how we go about uncovering fraud. A reviewed financial statement is much less than an audit. A review financial engagement would require the CPA to trace balance sheet information, namely cash, receivables, prepaids, any liabilities to supporting documents, and also requires the CPA to perform certain analytical review procedures. So it's the internal control features that you're questioning really isn't a part of a reviewed financial statement, although if the CPA, as he or she is going through this engagement, discovers a serious weakness in internal controls, then he or she is bound to bring it to the attention of the association and also to go further and investigate if something is thought to be out of line. But there isn't a reliance or even a cursory review of internal control features in a reviewed financial statement. It's mainly tracing information to supporting documents. And you'd be surprised what that can lead to in associations that don't have adequate bookkeeping. So it's a strong safeguard. It's just not the assurance that level of assurance that you'd receive in an audit. And also it's negative assurance. The opinion from the CPA on a reviewed engagement says that nothing came to our attention that would lead us to believe the financial statements are materially incorrect. An audit, you get positive assurance. So it's less than an audit, but it's much more than what homeowner associations are receiving at the present.
Thank you. Further questions?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Crumb.
What kind of cost is a homeowners association looking at to
have a review done on an annualized basis?
We're seeing a cost anywhere from $1,000 to $2,000, and perhaps on up to larger associations with a lot of activity. So you're probably, I would say, most associations are around the $1,000 to $2,000 range.
And if I may follow up, Mr. Chair, do you very often see misfeasance or malfeasance or negligence or any of those other sorts of nasty things?
Well, at present, a lot of the engagements that we have are homeowner associations that are professionally managed by property managers. So that takes a lot of associations out of the realm of, you know, most property managers. All the ones that I deal with have good controls because they ask me if I'm involved and I help them get there. It's the vast array of homeowner associations that aren't professionally managed that this bill is really gonna affect, I think. So to answer your question, most of the associations that we work with right now don't see any really major deficiencies in internal controls.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, sir. I wanted to add one other thing. In October 99, the legislature amended the condo and the plant community statute to expand the issue of reserve fund accumulations for condo and plant communities. That's part of our bill, a concern that homeowner associations that in the past did not have a lot in the way of reserves are now accumulating thousands, tens of thousands, even hundreds of thousands of dollars, and those funds are accessible by board members and others, and so now that these funds are growing, there's a greater need to have a closer oversight on them.
Okay. Gentlemen, are you aware of any opposition to this bill?
No.
Okay.
No.
All right.
Just one.
Yes, Representative Ackerman.
I would apologize for being called out, so I didn't hear the first part of your testimony. But suppose the organization that owns the facility is a multi-state corporation with units in several different states. What then would be the scope of the financial review here? Assuming, of course, the assessments were over the $75,000, just of the Oregon holdings, just of, or would you require a CPA review of the documents of the mega corporation?
I'm not aware of any homeowner associations or of that type. It's possible that you can have a developer that is in the development stage with different developments going on in different states, but this legislation does not consider the time span that the developer is in control of the association. It's after turnover. So I'm not aware of any homeowner associations in the state of Oregon that have out-of-state operations. They're domestic corporations with only operations within the state.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Jensen.
Thank you. Is there... It seems to me that there's nothing that would prohibit the homeowners association from, opting into their agreement to have this review, this financial review, without us having to go to the statute to mandate it. To respond to that, please.
Well, the ability for a membership to, while theoretically possible, members of homeowners associations typically don't rally to that extent unless it's hard enough to get a majority of them to a meeting. So getting the documents amended almost always originates from the board of directors, who are the ones that control the funds. It's very difficult to organize membership in a way to put this kind of thing in motion. So what we do have is a situation where we hear quite a few complaints from members that feel the board is mishandling funds or not providing regular financial statements, and there's a feeling of helplessness, of no way to have somebody look at it. We get that from individuals, but...
There's a lot of pressure when you're on the board of directors of a homeowner association. You're living with the folks that you're representing, and there's a lot of pressure to keep the expenses as low as possible. So a reviewed financial statement, even though we believe that it is something that is essential for good, sound financial management, it's one of those expenses that if you're under pressure from your friends and neighbors to keep the expenses as low as possible, that might be an option that you might seek to not spend money on that. So in a way, this legislation is going to aid boards of directors that really want to maintain their fiduciary responsibility for good, sound financial management to say to the membership, hey, we have to do this now. So it's kind of an out for them.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Jensen.
I would just have some concern about this type of managing of some of these. It strikes me that a whole bunch of other committees that I sit on have somewhat similar sort of problems, and I don't know how far down this sort of slope we go. And I am going to have to leave for a few minutes, but if I am in a position having to vote on it, I'd also have to declare some conflict of interest on this issue.
All right. Anything else? Thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate it. Is there any further discussion or anyone else here who wishes to testify on House Bill 2864? Okay, seeing none, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2864. Open a work session on House Bill 2864.
So, Mr. Chair?
Representative Crummel.
Would you like a motion to adopt the -1 amendments to 2864?
I'll take your inquiry as a motion, Representative Crummel.
That would be fine.
Representative Crummel moves the adoption of the -1 amendments to House Bill 2864. Is there a discussion on the -1s? Representative Anderson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Being a member and a partner in a homeowners association, do I declare a conflict of interest? Probably.
Oh, I don't think it hurts. I think that because it applies to everybody, I don't know that it's a general conflict. But if you want to, we'll note that before the vote, Representative Anderson declares a potential conflict of interest on the amendments to House Bill 2864.
Put me on that list, too.
Representative Crummel, also as a member of a homeowner. Anybody else? Member of a homeowner association?
Not me.
No?
Not me.
All right. So, conflicts so noted. All right. The motion is to adopt the amendments. Any objections? Hearing none, the amendments are adopted.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Crummel.
I would move House Bill 2864 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Crummel moves House Bill 2864 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion on that motion? Note for the record again, since it's a separate vote, both Representative Crummel and Representative Anderson declare potential conflicts of interest as they are members of homeowners associations. With that, Nancy, call the roll.
Ackerman?
Aye.
Barker?
Aye.
Pearson?
Excused.
Zabonsky?
Aye.
Chatterley?
Aye.
Chatterley?
Aye. Did you call Representative Anderson?
No.
You need to call?
Do I need to call?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, Anderson?
I need to call Crummel, too.
Yeah, even though they declare their conflicts, and Jensen is shown as excused. Excused.
And I'm an aye.
Okay. All right. The bill carries. Goes to the floor. Jerry, would you carry it?
Sure.
Okay, thanks. Okay, we are going to now move to a work session on House Bill 2694. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. House Bill 2694, if you recall, was essentially a consensus bill dealing with the relationship between dealers of farm implements and the manufacturers and the suppliers, and what has to happen when the dealers either come out with a recall or new parts or extra supplies are bought back. It's my understanding, as I think I told you all last time, that this legislation is similar to legislation that's moving through all the western states. You should have in front of you the Dash 3 amendments. It's my understanding they're consensus amendments. There are gentlemen here who can describe exactly what they do because they are rather complex. I've indicated that it'd be helpful for them to tell us exactly what they do other than what we've already heard in the bill, because I understand there were some additional changes that they testified to last time that were not in the original language that we heard.
Okay. Farm guys, come on up.
I had amendments.
Who wants to start?
I'll start, Mr. Chairman.
All right.
I'll introduce myself. I'm Ron Moore. I'm the president of the Pacific Northwest Hardware and Implement Association. We're a trade association. We represent farm machinery dealers in Oregon, Washington, Idaho, and Alaska. And do you want the rest of the members introduced right now?
Well, what
do you want to proceed?
Sure. Let's go ahead. Go ahead.
Okay. Verl Scheibe from St. Paul. I'm one of the principals in the Fisher Ernst John Deere Group in the Valley.
Good to see you again, Earl.
Don Schellenberg, farm guy, representing Oregon Farm Bureau.
Another farmer.
And an actual farmer.
All right. Good. Glad to have you all here. Go ahead, please.
Chairman Williams, members of the committee, the bill has several sections. It has provisions for buyback of equipment and parts upon termination by the suppliers. We are increasing that provision from 85% to 95% on the parts. We're also asking that the suppliers repurchase the computer equipment, hardware and software and communications equipment that they ask the dealers to buy from them to operate as a dealer. And we're also changing the statute so that the repurchase of whole goods and parts is FOB, the dealership. Under the dealer protection Section 4 part of the bill, the biggest and the most important amendment that we're asking for is that if the suppliers refuse to allow a transfer of the dealership ownership of the dealership or the financial ownership within the dealership, that they put that in writing to the dealers. Currently, they don't have to do that. We have had dealerships that were in the negotiating phases, one dealer making an offer to buy another dealership, and the suppliers just became silent. Therefore, nothing happened. And so now we're saying that if you're not going to allow the transfer, put it in writing and explain why. Good cause provisions, we're going to increase good cause termination provisions for market share. If the manufacturers decide that they want to terminate their agreement for market share, they have to give the dealer a one-year notice, and then 180 days after the effect of notice to for the dealership to cure, and if they don't cure, the notice is valid. I might go back to the front side, Section 1 of the bill. One of the most critical parts of the amendments in Section 1 is we're going to affect oral contracts the same as written contracts. Currently, legislation only applies to written contracts, and Burl can give you some real-life examples, if you will, on why that's important. We're going to ask that if the manufacturers affect the relevant market area of a dealership by establishing a new dealership or moving in another branch, that they notify all the dealers within a 75-mile radius. That's important because if you're a dealer and you're putting flooring equipment, taking in inventory, and all of a sudden another dealership is located in your trade area, you may be overstocked. So we just want notification. We're also going to increase our input provisions for warranty claims. Currently, the manufacturers may offer a warranty, but they don't necessarily compensate the dealer appropriately for doing the warranty work. This bill will state that if you offer a warranty, that you'll compensate the dealer at his posted labor, normal labor rate for doing the work. Today, some of the manufacturers will offer a dealer $30 an hour for performing their warranty work, which the customer, you know, demands. But that's not a good situation for the equipment dealer. We're also asking that the suppliers have to have product improvements because of errors in manufacturing, that they compensate the dealer appropriately for diagnostic time, for labor, and if it's a safety issue, that they also pay transportation. We've had cases where the manufacturers have some safety issues, demanded the dealers immediately rectify the problems, and the dealers had to incur the expense. So most of what you see before you today has been passed in the state of Washington last year, and so we're looking for parity between the states that our dealers operate in, and that's what this bill basically does.
Okay. Rural? Oh, do you want to ask a question or wait until we hear from
you? No, I was just going to say, while he was just to, perhaps to help along here, I've been looking at the drafting issues that I think we had some problems with on the Dash 1 amendments, and we spoke after the initial hearing on this thing. It looks to me like everything's been fixed that we had talked about. So
correct.
I forgot the man from Rickreall was
right.
Here to save us.
I met with my Rickreall board here at the Capitol a couple days ago, so we talked about this bill.
Yeah. Good.
There you go. Mr. Scheibe.
Mr. Chair, one comment regarding Section 1. A couple of years ago, we had a situation with one of our, what we call a short line supplier. There's the major manufacturers and then the short line manufacturers, the short line being those other than the major line that we handle. And most of these items in this whole bill are to put the short line manufacturers on parity with the major liners. The major lines do supply a fair warranty claims, or we submit the warranty claims. They pay us what our published rate is. There's a lot of the shortliners do not. And on Section 1, the oil agreement that was referred to earlier, we had a situation with one of our shortline suppliers where we did have an agreement, an oil agreement, with over just shy of $1 million worth of equipment. And to make a long story short, he didn't honor his part of that agreement, and we ended up having oversupply of inventory that we could not move, that they would not take back. And it cost us a lot of money just to go through that. This hopefully would clear that up. The other part of that is, again, on the warranty issues, a lot of the short line suppliers do not pay equitably on warranty claims, where our major liners do. They have a good understanding of what it takes. They accept that responsibility. If there's a manufacturing defect, they take care of it. A lot of our shortliners don't. This puts them all on parity.
Okay. Thank you. Don?
Mr. Chairman, many of you around the Capitol here, infrastructure is a word that's used often, and everybody knows what infrastructure is. What people don't often understand is that agriculture has an infrastructure as well, and the machinery dealers are one part of that infrastructure. They're a key aspect to the agriculture industry. This bill helps them. What helps them helps us. And so just wanted to advise the chair and the committee of our support for the bill. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Are there questions for any of the panel?
One question.
Yes, Representative Kozanski.
I want to make certain that we do what you need to have done, but is there any chance by passing this type of legislation that you may see the actual manufacturers trying to bring in manufactured-owned dealerships to displace local dealerships?
If that happens, that's what I'm doing. I mean, we think that we as independent business people can deal with the farm community on a much better way. And, in fact, there are have been in the past, manufacturers have owned dealerships, and they found through their own experience that it doesn't work out very well for them.
Good.
Mm-hmm. Better for you to assume the risk than for them, right?
Mm-hmm. That's true.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, good. Thank you for your testimony, panel. Representative Zahner, this is your bill. Do you want to say anything? It's doing pretty well by itself, but if you want to come up and roll the die first.
Let
we're
that
happy
be a warning. Yeah.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Brzezinski.
I move the Dash 3s in House Bill 2694.
Representative Brzezinski moves the Dash 3 amendments to House Bill 2694. Is there any discussion? Any objection? The Dash 3s are adopted into the bill.
Mr. Chair, I'll now move House Bill 2694 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Brzezinski moves House Bill 2694 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on that motion? Representative Jensen, just to bring you up to speed, this is the bill relating to the farm implement retailers. We adopted Dash 3 amendments, which were presented to the committee with consensus amendments with supporting testimony from the Oregon Farm Bureau and supporting silence from Representative Zahner.
Okay.
So the amendments have been adopted, and the motion is to move the bill, just so you know where we're at.
Okay, thank you.
Any further discussion? All right, Nancy.
Ackerman.
Aye.
Anderson.
Aye.
Barker.
Aye.
Jensen.
Can I have a second?
Yeah. Skip Jensen and come back.
Cromwell.
Aye.
McPherson.
Excuse.
Rozanski.
Aye.
Shetterly.
Aye.
Jeb Williams.
Aye. House Bill.
Aye.
Oh, there we go. I'm sorry. We've got to let you vote, don't I, Bob?
That's all right.
House Bill 2694 is amended, moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Volunteer carrier?
I'm thinking of this. Bob wants it.
I'll think.
You want to carry it, Bob? Well, yeah, that's a good idea. Bill. We don't normally do this, but Click, you want to carry this bill on the floor?
I can, or you can put it on the consent calendar.
Well, we don't do consents in here. We like to make a record. Besides, you didn't get a chance to talk about it, so you'll get your shot on the floor. All right, we'll assign that bill to Representative Zahner since it's his. And Representative Dingfelder, you're here for 3259. Am I right? All right, we'll open a work session on House Bill 3259 and invite you forward. Do you need Mr. Landauer with you on this?
He's back there in case I get in trouble.
All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm here. My name is Jackie Dingfelder, State Representative for House District 45, and I'm here to talk about the amendments to House Bill 3259, which is the meth lab notification bill. And hopefully you have the dash twos in front of you. Thank you.
We do.
The dash twos, which were already, well, actually, the dash two amendments basically incorporate changes to the concerns that were brought up here. And I want to thank Representative Ackerman for his acumen and catching the, actually, we had person in as the entity being notified. And if you will recall, this opened up some discussion about who would need to receive the notification. So after consultation with legislative council and representatives from the cities, we decided to go with the word residents, and essentially one letter of notification to the occupants of a residence would be sufficient notification under this statute. We also added that the state, in addition to a local government, could provide notice if so desired. This acknowledges that in many areas the state is the enforcement agency and a local government may not know about the contaminated property. So this, committee members, I believe, is a good government bill, and these notices will provide important public health and safety information. I thank you for your time here today and for the previous public hearing, and I respectfully request that you adopt the Dash 2 amendments and forward this bill to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Representative Dingfelder. Are there questions for Representative Dingfelder about the Dash 2 amendments or its impact on the bill? Everyone want to take just a minute and read through it, because this is one we had quite a bit of discussion about in committee, as I recall. Any questions? Okay.
I have another one. I'm back to this notice thing again, and I hate to bring it up. I mean, it's sometimes a technical objection, but sometimes I'm worried about it, particularly when the notice, I'm clear about the notice within a city because you have city limits, but I'm not clear what a rural area is if a rural area would be within the city limits. It might be clearer
upon Mr. Landauer, who helped me with these amendments.
Notices for people within city limits and one set outside of city limits, rather than trying to figure out what a rural area is if it's within the city limit.
And the cavalry comes over the hill.
The C team has arrived. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Mark Landauer with the Office of Government Relations for the City of Portland. I think that the answer to Representative Ackerman's question is right. It may not be covered. For example, an unannexed, unincorporated area within an urban growth boundary may very well sort of fall outside of this and what type of notice they may get. This was just actually brought up to me this morning, or just actually about 10 minutes before the committee opened, by Mr. Levy with the Realtors Association, and I think that if we were to get that corrected, perhaps on the other side, it would be probably covered the entire state rather than those unincorporated areas within urban growth boundaries.
We were trying to be thorough, Mr. Chair.
I understand. This is what this process is all about.
Exactly.
The refiner's fire. Welcome. Put yourself on the record and talk to us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Harlan Levy, staff attorney with the Oregon Association of Realtors. I want to thank the sponsor of this bill for including us from the very beginning and addressing our concerns. We have no problem with the bill. I did notice the same thing that Representative Ackerman noticed earlier and pointed it out to Mr. Landauer, that you may, in fact, be having that situation where you have an unannexed portion of a county that is within a UGB falling between the cracks. That would probably be something that could easily be fixed on the other side.
This sounds very much like Representative Prozanski's municipal court bill.
Been there, done that.
Yeah. Which set of boundaries does it fall within? It's like a three-dimensional algebraic equation.
You can use my chalkboard.
Okay. Well, so would it be your intent, Representative Dingfelter, to correct this on the Senate side?
Yes, sir. That would be. And you know, it's one of these things that you always think there's a simple solution, and then there never seems to be a simple solution. But we will talk to LC about addressing that.
In this committee, we refer to that as Prozanski's rule.
Prozanski's rule. I like that. To address the unannexed portion of the county. And I will talk to LC about drafting up some language, but that would be my preference, Mr.
Okay.
Chair.
Well, I think given the lateness of the committee time for House bills, this is in sort of a do-or-die position, and so it does seem to make sense to me that we could adopt the Dash 2s, which do much of what you want, and then with the involvement and encouragement of Mr. Landauer, Mr. Levy, and yourself, that you can get the amendments prepared and fix it on the Senate side.
I appreciate that, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Any other questions for this panel? All right.
Chair.
Yeah, Representative Prozanski.
Move the Dash 2s into House Bill 3259.
Representative Prozanski, and don't leave Representative Dingfelter. Just you want to hang out here for
sure.
Just a second. Representative Prozanski moves the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 3259.
I'm afraid Representative Ackerman will find something else before you leave the time.
Well, we've over-lawyered this already, so let the senators do it now.
So the Dash 2s are being moved into the bill. Is there any discussion on the Dash 2s? Any objection? The Dash 2s are adopted.
Mr. Chair, I'll move House Bill 3259 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Prozanski moves House Bill 3259 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on that motion? Okay, call the roll, Nancy.
Ackerman?
Aye.
Anderson?
Yes.
Aye.
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 Aye. Excuse?
Aye.
Excuse? Aye. House Bill 3259 is amended and moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And in the spirit of the day, Representative Dingfelter and his old Judiciary Committee alumni yourself will let you carry your bill on the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that. And I do miss the fun around, especially with the puns that you and Representative Shetterly would throw out. I'm missing that.
You know, we're not as funny as we used to be. All right.
Thank you.
We're going to open a public hearing now on House Bill, or excuse me, a work session on House Bill 3318. Counsel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. If you recall, House Bill 3318 deals with creation of false identity cards, licenses, and permits, and other material of identity theft. There was a concern about last time we heard this, that it might encompass kids making fake IDs to get tobacco or alcohol, and there was a certain concern that would create a fiscal impact. the dash one amendments that you have in front of you create an affirmative defense that the person being charged was either under the age of 18 or 21, with respectively, depending on what they're making the fake ID for, tobacco or alcohol, and that's what the purpose of making that fake ID was in that circumstance, and that would significantly limit any impact that the bill would have fiscally, and also would not catch up those younger kids who, when this is more of a serious identity theft bill as opposed to something trying to keep youths away from alcohol and tobacco. So I think that's what the dash ones do, and it's ready to go otherwise.
Committee, want to take just a minute and read the dash ones? Make sure we know what we're doing.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Jensen.
Is this... This dash one is making then the assumption that 20-year-olds or 17-year-olds, as the case may be, are not intellectually enough to develop to be able to understand what the crime is.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Jensen, it's my understanding that the sole inclusion of these two provisions was that if we left these in, it would end up catching a lot of kids up in this law when there are other laws that prevent such activity, and at the same time, this law was supposed to be specifically focused on identity theft, and those individuals would not be seeking to impersonate somebody else. They're simply trying to make it look as if they're older than they are so that they could purchase alcohol or tobacco.
But
Representative Jensen,
that there's still a crime as far as identity theft is concerned.
If these individuals, if I might, Representative, if these individuals were engaged in the crime of identity theft, this affirmative defense would not apply because it does say that they created the fake ID solely for the purpose of either purchasing alcohol or tobacco. I guess it is a form of identity theft in that they're impersonating somebody with the same name but a different birth date, but the proponents weren't interested, as I understand it, in catching these types of people up in this particular law.
Representative Brzezinski.
Mr. Chair, you know, the way I'm looking at the dash ones, it sets up, as it clearly states, an affirmative defense, so these individuals, whoever, can still be charged with the crime of unlawful production of identification cards, etc., and potentially face what would be an enhanced from a Class A misdemeanor to a Class C felony. And from what I remember the testimony, they wanted to increase the penalty for the people who are actually producing the identification for identity theft. You're going to have individuals such as your example, Representative Jensen, that are 20, 17 years of age, potentially still charged with the underlying crime, but they would be able to raise the defense that, no, I wasn't doing this to take on someone else's identity for some other purpose besides solely purchasing alcohol and or tobacco, as the case may be. I mean, the burden is going to still be on the individual that's going to be charged to come forward and prove that they weren't committing the crime for the purposes of the intent of the bill, and that they're only trying to do alcohol. I mean, there is some... I know Mr. Martinez is here, and I think maybe it'd be wise to have him up to give his comments, because, I mean, you're still going to see people being charged with underlying offense, and then the question is, if they get an attorney, they go to the district attorney's office or to the city prosecutor's office and say, hey, you know, this is what they're trying to use it for, or if it's captured by the officer in his report, that may... keep them from being charged, but if not, they're going to be charged, and they're going to have the burden to prove that or disprove that they were doing it for other purposes than alcohol and tobacco.
Mr. Martinez, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Tim Martinez here today on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association. Council did a great job explaining the purpose of the amendments. You may recall, Representative Jensen, that the criminal defense bar was a little concerned with the bill as introduced, that there would be perhaps an overzealous deputy district attorney. I know Representative Prasansky would say that doesn't exist, but that would indeed try to charge somebody who simply made an ID or borrowed an, or actually made an ID to show that they were 21 to buy beer and for no other purpose would be charged under our proposal with a felony. There are other sections of the statute, as counsel mentioned, that does address this issue of underage. So we were more than willing to accommodate the criminal defense bar in making it clear that what we were after here was folks that were producing these IDs as a method of increasing their ability to commit identity theft and not to deal with either the issue of buying cigarettes or beer.
Representative Barker.
Mr. Martinez, so I catch a guy that's 20 years old and he's got a computer full and printed out all these IDs for identity theft, and he said, I was only selling these so kids could buy whiskey.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Barker, no, because this is only one person that's making these IDs. If it is somebody that's making them for other folks, they could indeed be charged. It's only for the person to purchase alcohol, not for the group of people. We made a very there was some discussion about this, because if you look, we got this, I forget what the ORS is, but where we got this out of ORS, there is actually a third piece that talks about using it simply as an age, and we didn't include that. We just wanted these two examples and only for that individual.
It does say the person. Thank you.
That's the same.
And again, lest we think that someone under the age of 21 or 18, depending on the product, is using false identification for the purpose of purchasing that product, there are numerous other provisions under the ORS for which they would be charged. So it's not as if they don't get charged. They just don't get charged under a Class C felony that could include 5 years in jail and a $100,000 fine or both. It's just a different level.
No, it's not the production. In those cases, they're actually in possession of it to carry out the act.
Right. Okay.
Mr. Chair, I'll move the dash ones.
All right. Representative Barker moves dash one amendments to House Bill 3318. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Dash ones are in the bill. Representative Barker.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3318 with the dash one amendments to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Barker moves House Bill 3318 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Okay. Call the roll.
Ackerman.
Aye.
Anderson.
Aye.
Barker.
Aye.
Jensen.
Aye.
Trumbull.
Aye.
McPherson.
Excused.
Zlonsky.
Aye.
Dederly.
Excused.
Chair Williams.
Aye. House Bill 3318 is amended and moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Barker, you want to carry it? Okay.
Yes, please.
All right. We'll now open work session on House Bill 3329. Council.
Moment. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, House Bill 3329 authorizes the DOJ to initiate and participate in efforts to prepare for and assist in the delivery of services to individuals traumatized by acts of mass violence. We have no amendments. As far as I know, the bill's ready to move if we want to move it.
Okay. Was Mr. Shepard here? Is he out in the hallway? Does anybody know? Okay, why don't you come up to the table? Colleagues, we had hearings on this bill, and I have a letter in my file. Did everyone else get a copy of it?
Mm-hmm. I think so.
Dated April 7th?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good. I was worried that I was the only one who had seen it, and I forgot to send it out to everybody else. But we have a letter from Mr. Shepard describing what one of the issues was raised at the hearing the last time we had this bill up. There was concerns about the the definition, I think, of delivering services, and the question was, what are services? And I think Mr. Shepard, in his letter of April 7th, attempted to satisfy the committee's inquiry as to what kind of services would be provided by these teams. So with that, if you'd go ahead and put your name on the record, and we'll take some questions. Representative Jensen?
Let me say that the questions, I didn't realize I was going to be so fortunate that the questions I raised would bring Ms. Gallagher here to bring testimony for us. She's an old friend from back in Pendleton days when she was there, and I'm pleased to have her here. And she's already convinced me that my questions were foolish.
Chair, maybe we should just move the...
Wow. Well, there you go. That pays to have somebody from your hometown, I guess. Huh? Well, when you said you were from the AG's office and you were here to help, Ms. Gallagher, we took you at your word. Are there questions for Ms. Gallagher about the bill, or did the letter satisfy everyone's questions about what services are being described here?
I just want to note that I did not get a copy of the letter, which...
Oh, well, there you
here,
go.
Here.
Read away.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative
Brzezinski. I'll move House Bill 3329 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Brzezinski moves House Bill 3329 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion? Okay. Nancy?
Ackerman?
Aye.
Anderson?
Aye.
Parker?
Aye.
Jensen?
Aye.
Trumbull?
Aye.
Excuse.
Aye.
Sounds like an aye.
First, I want Representative Shirley to tell us which bill we're on.
Her bill.
Her bill.
3329.
Good guess.
No, I knew that.
Yeah, all right. We have Williams votes aye. House Bill 3329 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Who wants to carry this one? Any volunteers?
I'll do that if you like.
All right, Representative Brzezinski. Yeah, and colleagues, as I indicated, and Ms. Gallagher, would you let the folks, because I know that this is sort of tied to 3330 generally, that it's our intent to have 3330 back up on the schedule on Monday.
Mr. Chair.
So our hope is that the amendments are prepared by that date.
We were just doing 3330 out in my office across the hall, and I think we got that all straightened up.
Will we be able to get the amendments by Monday?
I think so.
Okay. All right. Good. Well, that's our intent to have it up on that date then. Okay. We have eliminated 2924 from the calendar, and I think that takes us through our business committee. We had talked about a Tuesday meeting next week. I was informed that I would not live to see Wednesday if we left the Tuesday on that date.
What?
Because it conflicts with the governor's bowling for food bowling event going on.
Split happens.
Yeah, the split happens event. I won't tell you who actually threatened me, but I will be having a conversation with the state police later this afternoon.
I could probably give you her next.
Did she leave?
Yeah, she's already out of the room. So I think we're looking at probably a Wednesday evening meeting next week. Ooh. Patsy will notice it up. I know that that's going to be problematic for some of you, and we'll just do the best we can. So with that, committee, we're adjourned for the afternoon.
That'll be at 5 o'clock or 5:30?
We'll go at 5:30.